Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with greed. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And I'm going to keep this intro tight today because I really want to get to today's guest, which is Chris Mercer from the band Sliver. And he's a Denverite by way of Washington, D.C., and so there's a little bit of that gruffness going on there. But don't let that fool you. He's a really thoughtful, really interesting dude, and that's kind of why I want to get into it right away. Because this conversation was really hard for me to keep on track because there were so many tangents I wanted to follow, but you can't follow everything. You have to sometimes let things slip by and just let the conversation unfold as it does. But they are running a benefit out of the Marquee Theater December 21st, and I'll be there. If you want to come check that out, it is donation-based, and it is all to bring awareness to the youth homelessness problem that we're facing, not only here in Denver, but all across the United States. It's an epidemic that needs a lot more attention. And the proceeds are going to go to Sox Place and Urban Peak, two really well-thought-out organizations. And the bands are Sliver, AFD, Swamp Rats, Bert Olsen, and Stereo Shifter. So it's a good night of punk rock and just, you know, rock and roll in general. But I'm going to get out of here right now. And as we're winding down our 2018, we got just a little bit left in the tank before the show goes on a short, short hiatus. But before that happens, let's talk to Chris Mercer. Hi, it's nice to meet you. It's good to see you.
It's nice to meet you as well.
So, I was actually referred to you by Rachel, the last guest that was just on the show.
Yes.
We had a really intense conversation, and it was pretty awesome, but she was talking to me saying that you've got a pretty intense story as well.
So, yes. I grew up in Washington, D.C. I grew up with a stutterer as well. So, I got picked on a lot. And I know it sounds a little petty and what not, but it sucks, like,
yeah,
being picked on for something that you can't help, like, it really hurts somebody's self-esteem. So, I wound up getting into music. I started playing guitar and singing because I found out I don't stutter when I sing. But the damage, I guess, was already done, and I started getting into hard drugs.
How long was it that you were... how old were you when you picked up music for the first time?
About 12. My friend in DC, he showed me the Bad Brains, and they were actually my introduction to like punk.
Yeah.
And like a different side of music than what's on the radio. And I was blown away. Like, I was fucking floored.
Yeah.
Then,
The Bad Brains will do that to you.
I've actually, living in D.C., I've seen AHR around town.
Yeah.
And that guy's nuts, unfortunately. Well, nuts isn't the right word to use. I actually don't like describing people like that. He has a lot of mental illness issues. He's a schizophrenic now.
Yeah.
And
I had heard that.
Yeah, it sucks. So from there, I started to get into like more noisier stuff. I started getting into the Melvins, the Wipers, Nirvana. Kurt Cobain is why I picked up a guitar.
He's why a lot of people picked up a guitar.
Apparently. From there, I found bands like the Velvet Underground. I started going to local shows in D.C. And then I started playing in a band out there. Even though I was doing that and that was healthy, I still had the depression issues from the inadequacy that comes from having a disability. So I got into hard drugs when I was 16, and then I realized what it was doing to me at the age of 19, because I was homeless at the time. I had nowhere to go, and I was like, holy shit, this is like my fault. I mean, if I would have never started doing narcotics, I would have never wound up homeless.
Yeah.
So I signed myself into rehab, and my drug of choice was heroin, and I haven't touched it since I signed myself into rehab.
Yeah.
So that's a positive thing. Then when I got out of rehab, I was still homeless. And I took a little break from playing music. I got a job. I got a place. Then I got the bright idea, because I was tired of living in D.C. and seeing like the same things over and over. Like, there's only so many times you can go to Northern Virginia or like up to Baltimore before it's like, yeah, I'm sick of all of this.
Yeah.
And I decided to move out here. I wound up homeless when I like was out here, but the difference was I was actually clean. So I was able to get back on my feet pretty quick. I stayed at a homeless shelter in downtown. Then once I got to place, I started another band here. It's a band called Sliver, and, yeah, I've been playing music ever since I got on my feet out and, like, here as, like, my outlet, as the way to, get out what I'm thinking and not bottle up anything. So I also went to college for a little bit. I went for psychology and human services because I was really interested in helping out the homeless population and people who suffer from like addiction. And what sucks about that is I do like helping people, but because of everything I've been through, having to help people who have been through the same thing I have, actually face to face and not through music or something like that, it was triggering. I wanted to go back out and use, because I realized I couldn't save everyone.
Yeah.
And it really hurt. So I quit working at the homeless shelter and started doing construction. In the process, my band was doing stuff, and we wound up doing some pretty cool things. We played the Westward Showcase before. That was kind of rad. It was super weird. Like, I never thought that we would be catered to in a VIP, like, room. And I was like, what the hell is this? Like, why are, like, you giving us stuff?
Yeah.
We don't deserve any of this. So, but Itin was pretty cool. I'm glad I got the opportunity to do that. We've gone on tour as well. That's fun. It's exhausting.
Yeah.
But I had a lot of fun in doing it. We've played a few different festivals. I've set up a festival. I actually set up a show at the Marquee on the 21st. To use that as a platform for awareness for youth homelessness. It's donation based, and all the proceeds are going to Urban Peak and Sox Place. Sox Place is a drop-in center where kids can go and get food if they're homeless. An Urban Peak is literally a homeless shelter for people from the ages of, I think, 16 up to 25. And they've helped out a lot of people. So I really want those places to stay.
Yeah.
Around, like, all of the bands that are playing, like my band, AFD, we all have, we've either been on the verge of being homeless, been homeless ourselves, or been affected by somebody we care about being homeless. The bassist of AFD, Connor, he's 17, and that kid has had to combat homelessness quite a, like, few times.
Yeah.
And he's one of the most positive kids I've ever met. So I'm like, I'm super proud to know someone like that who's that young and who's not only combated being homeless, they've beat it by being responsible, holding a job, doing all that dumb, boring stuff.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, you've just gone through, in 10 minutes, a litany of things that is mind-blowing on so many levels. And to still be sitting here alive and with your faculties intact. But there's a road to get there. So I want to go back, if we can.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could just tell me a little bit about how we get to that first part. So for the first part, I guess my question is, what were your parents like at the beginning of all of this, when you were young and the first thing hits you, there's a speech impediment?
So my parents were always supportive of what I wanted to do outside of music. They got a little iffy about that, but
of course.
So my dad and my mom would always fight for what they thought was best and for me. It may not have always been what was best. And we've definitely spoken about that and over, like, the years. And they've admitted as well, yeah, we may have not made the right decision here and there. And honestly, that's a huge step for parents. So thanks, Mom. Thanks, Dad. But one thing I can't say is they didn't care and love in me. They would always tell me, even though I have a speech impediment, and they wouldn't say it to be demeaning or anything, they'd be all like, there's nothing wrong with in you. You just talk a little different.
Yeah.
Like, you and these kids who make fun of you and for it, fuck them. Like, you're not going in to see them in 10 years. Now, I didn't realize that, and as like a kid, I was like, no, you don't understand, I'm angsty.
Yeah.
But they were absolutely right.
Well, but that is your reality.
Yes.
For certainly for the section of your life that you're living in, your reality is, this fucking sucks.
Yeah.
Everybody's treating me like this, and there's this thing about me that I can't change.
Mm-hmm.
What am I supposed to do with all of this? So, I mean, yeah, all you got to do is wait it out,
mm-hmm.
and then hindsight kicks
yes.
in. If you're lucky, you'll get the opportunity to recognize that you got past something.
Yes.
But that's not also to diminish the fact that you did go through something.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not nothing.
Yes. Yes. And whenever my parents would say there's nothing wrong with like you, they weren't trying to push aside the way I was feeling. That's how I felt and as like a kid. But putting myself in their shoes, if I had a child who I adored and somebody was making fun of them for something they couldn't help, I'd probably say and like the same thing. Cause
yeah,
well, no, because I've been through it. I know I'd say something different. I'd be brutally honest and I'd be like, yeah, it sucks. Like it's hard, but my parents were and right. And this is something I would quote them on is fuck 'em.
Yeah.
Like, they're not going to be in your life in 10 years. And if they are, they're going to be envious. And I mean, I don't know if anyone's envious. I hope not. Like, but, I definitely have seen a lot of success. Despite of everything I've been through, combating depression as well, anxiety, then topping that off with addiction and homelessness. It is a fucking miracle I'm sitting here.
Yeah.
Because I'd be lying if I said I've never attempted to hurt myself or take my own life. Or I mean, if you're homeless and you feel that you have nothing, you have nowhere to go. And that's one of the things I'm super grateful for music, because that's been my outlet for the longest time. The first time I like was homeless when I like was 19, and I was on heroin. Listened to Nirvana's In Utero nonstop, and the like irony in that is Kurt Cobain went and killed himself, and that whole album is about him wanting to die. But that gave a kid on the streets hope.
Yeah.
And I was able to pull myself out because I had bands like Nirvana, the Melvins, the Wipers, the Bad Brains. Like, I really appreciate that. It was angsty. It was, some of it was juvenile. Like, the Descendants are one of the most juvenile bands I've ever heard. Like,
yeah.
I don't really like them anymore because Milo's kind of misogynistic. But that's a totally different, like, discussion.
You know, that's a thing, too. Like, I mean, I think about bands like The Descendants. And, I mean, that was a band that kind of, at the time that it hit me, it saved my life.
Yes.
You know? So it was like, a lot of those bands, they... I mean, that's my nostalgia stuff.
Yes.
It may not be my go-to now, but every time I hear it, like, It means something different to me, maybe, than it means to them.
Yes. And I'd be a lying if I said every time that Milo goes into college, gets and put on, I don't get a little bit excited, because, I mean, that's one of the albums I listened to as, like, a kid.
Yeah.
It was...
The bass riff on My Edge is one of the greatest punk rock bass lines ever.
Yeah, most certainly. And you take bands like the Descendants, Nirvana, the Bad Brains, the Dead Kennedys, the Melvins, Sonic and Youth, and the Velvet Underground.
Yeah.
And they may sound a little different, but they all have one underlying factor that makes them similar, and why I gravitated towards stuff like that, and what I tried to do with my music. It's originality. It's them being themselves.
Yeah.
They're not trying to hide anything. That's where they're most comfortable, is playing their guitar or their drums or whatever, and creating something.
Yeah.
Making something that's more important than, all right, I'm going to this shitty 9-to-5 job that I don't even care about.
Yeah.
Like, and that's why I think it gave me so much hope. Because these bands were just doing what they wanted to do. And that's something I really admired.
Yeah, it's like it gives you the courage to be different.
Yes. And that's one of the things I truly appreciate about Kurt Cobain, is when I was a kid... Him, HR, and Ian MacKay, and all of them, like, they advocated for people who were different.
Yeah.
They, there's interviews with Kurt Cobain, and this is back in the 90s, and he's talking about gender dysphoria, essentially, whenever he's talking about, I don't identify with the masculine stare in Rio type. It makes me very uncomfortable. Masculinity makes me very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And him, Ian MacKay, all of them were very pro I had the word at the top of my head. So, I'm going to sound a little dumb for a second. Pro-different.
Yeah. I like pro-different.
And the fact that, fucking in the late 80s, early 90s, when it was frowned upon to be gay.
Yeah.
You had Kurt Cobain on MTV saying homophobes and pissing me off.
Yeah.
You had Ian MacKay throwing out racist out of his shows.
Yeah.
You had HR just punching a racist in the face.
Yeah.
Like, it was very inspiring. And so Denver is lucky. I mean, yeah, you have the older, I guess, punk crowd who wants to be edge lords because of Sid fucking Vicious and Fat Mike.
Yeah.
And the Sex Pistols are the boy band of punk rock, and NoFX just sucks. But you start to go into the younger crowd where my band would lie, or AFD, or Swamp Rats, or something like that. And they're very accepting people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, especially the kids who go to when these shows. They are like the most open-minded kids I have ever met. And they actually make really good music, too. My friend's band, Target, they're this garage hardcore band. Their bassist is 16. They're fucking rad.
Yeah.
Like, and it makes me happy to see something like that, that these kids have an outlet, a place to go. Have you ever been up to Seven Circle?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I really enjoy that place. That's probably my favorite place to play in Denver.
Yeah, that place is unreal. Mm-hmm. The thing that I was struck by immediately was, first of all, when you walk in there, it just looks like shit.
Yeah.
And then the sound is amazing.
It's fucking phenomenal.
Yeah, I don't know what they're doing there, but every penny of whatever they're getting went into the sound, because the sound is better than, I mean, it would rival so many other places, I guarantee it.
Yes.
Sound is always excellent.
And the kids who go to that place, I mean, as long as it's not god awful or like really offensive just and for and like the sake of being edgy, they get super into it. Like, yeah. The first time I played there, we played the Rock Against Trump. And I took my, I had this Make America Great Again hat. I crossed out America and wrote sliver. So it said, make sliver great again. And then I went on, and after our like third song, I went on a little bit of a like spiel about how capitalism in general just sucks. And we need to like resist this as much as we can. So I threw the hat in the crowd and the crowd lit it on fire. So during one of our songs, I jumped into the crowd to mosh with them and they wound up crowd surfing me. Then at the very end, I ripped all the strings off of my guitar and I smashed it. The crowd lit it on fire also.
Yeah.
Like that, we've played there, we've started a food fight, because I told people to bring bagels inside and just throw them everywhere. I played guitar with a bagel too. Didn't exactly work, but it kind of did.
Yeah.
It's just a super fun and accepting place. I've met the most diverse but really accepting people through these DIY venues and playing shows, and I really appreciate it. Like, it's helped shaped in me from playing ever since I was 16 up until now. It's kind of shaped me to who I am today.
But there's that whole section of time there as well for I mean, you mentioned that you started playing music when you were
12.
Yeah. And then you became addicted to drugs at 16.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what is the bridge between 12 and 16? How do we get from there to there?
I mean, it was typical, like,
were you playing gigs and shit? Or
no,
like...
no. I
just dicking around with the guitar?
Yeah, so when I first got into playing guitar, I sat there with Nirvana's Nevermind and like In Utero, and I listened to it, both of them, back to back with a guitar in my lap. And within about 2 or 3 days, I figured out everything that Kurt Cobain was playing. And I showed my dad, and I was like, "Dad, look at what I can do now."
Yeah.
And I showed him like every fucking song on both of those albums with me playing along, and my dad was like, "How did you figure that out?" I was like, "I don't know. I got bored, and I just didn't want to play games, so I just sat here with this, and well, I can play guitar now, I guess." And,
yeah,
my dad was all like, "I don't know if I should be proud or extremely worried."
Worried.
And, I was all like, "It is what it is."
Yeah.
Then, I just kept playing. I kept going to school. I'd play video games a lot. Then, once I got to high school, I started messing around and smoking pot. Then I got offered acid, then ecstasy, then shrooms, and then coke, yeah. Then...
Yeah, yeah. Then.
And then there came the heroin. And
yep.
That's and what got me. And I would never... So a huge misconception about junkies is they steal all the time. I never stole from like my parents or the ones I cared about or people in general. I was angry though. I was really angry, and it didn't. It was partially because of everything that transpired up until I started doing it, and the fact that I was doing it in the first place, like. I was hurtful, and I would do really stupid shit. I would get in trouble with cops.
Well, that's also a period of time in every person's life when you're going through all of these emotional changes. And what you don't know is that everybody around you is completely unsure of who they are.
Yes.
Everybody.
I've realized that as I've got older. Yeah.
Everybody is trying to figure everything out. And sometimes being a complete dick to the kid who talks funny is the only thing in the world that suddenly makes them feel like they've got a handle on something.
Yes.
And then they get older and they're either A... Yeah, I made fun of this fucking weirdo once. How funny is that? And they're assholes still.
Yeah.
And they're even worse assholes because nobody's taken them down yet. Or they get better, and you hope they get better. And you hope they go. You hope that it kept them up at night to the point where they corrected. You know?
Yeah.
Like, I hope my biggest wish for my bullies is that they corrected. And that no one else had to suffer through that shit.
Yeah.
I don't need them to tell me they corrected, because I don't give a fuck about you.
Yeah.
I mean, still, fuck you, still. But I do hope for the sake of yourself and the sake of the rest of the world that you were able to figure that out.
Yes.
I don't need to be a part of that equation anymore.
People, especially after having... It's fun, Annie. You have the tiniest success... Something like in music.
Yeah.
You get an article written about you. You do something in like this.
Yeah.
People who you grow up with hit you up immediately.
Yeah.
And I've had a lot of people be all like, oh, Chris, I'm sorry I made fun of you and you're doing so well. I'm all like, yo, you like know I'm poor, right? Like, what
do you want?
Yeah, like I don't care about what you said about me. If anything, it fueled me to do what I'm doing now, so thanks. Like, I, like, appreciate you being a dickhead. Like,
Yeah, it's weird, right?
Yeah, there were these kids I grew up with who would always party in this basement. And, there's this kid named Mike. Oh, I don't know if I should have said his name. Ah, fuck him. But, they were the most obnoxious fucking people. Because they were kind of jockey, but they were, like, wannabe, like, edgy, emo, goth, or whatever. And I was all like, yo, you all are bashing me for doing what I do, but you're doing the exact same thing. It's just socially acceptable because it's alcohol.
Yeah.
Like, and actually you have a greater chance of dying than like what I do with opiates. So
yeah,
it's a win-win for me. And, so it was funny. Because a lot of them grew up and they did change and they're not, like, shitbags anymore. Like, And I'm truly great and great and grateful and for that, that they were able to open up their eyes and all that. But like, as a kid, fuck them.
Yeah.
They were such dicks.
Totally.
And it was funny because, again, I've been hit up by these people and they've actually went and checked out my music and been all like, holy shit, that's him? Like, we thought he was going to amount to nothing. And I was all like, you all knew I played guitar. Like,
yeah.
I this is something I've done ever since I was a kid, and I never hid it from anyone. It was never like, I've been gigging ever since I was 16, like,
But with your parents being supportive, and with,
My parents weren't exactly supportive. So, my dad, it was. To an extent. He's the one who bought me my first guitar,
mm-hmm.
and he gave me that push to want to start playing, to boost my self-esteem and all that.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful because it did. It gave me a purpose. It finally showed that, oh shit, I guess I can be good at something. My mom was a little more apprehensive because my mom was home a lot more. So she was listening to all the bands that I was blaring.
Yeah.
And it was funny. She never tripped out about Bad Brains. Never tripped out about Mine or Threat or the Melvins or Mudhoney or something like that. The second I put on Nirvana, though, she was all like, hold on a second. I know who and like this and guy is. He did heroin and killed himself. And I was all like, good job for knowing basic pop culture? Like,
yeah.
What does that have to do with me? And she was all like, you're going to do heroin and kill you yourself too. Hindsight being 20/20, she like was right about one of the things.
That's a to-do list better left unfinished, I think.
Yeah. So I don't know. I always found it funny that like bands like Bad Brains or something never really pissed her off. But the second she fucking heard Nirvana, she was like, oh my god. It's fucking druggy music. Mom, it's all druggy music. Like,
yeah.
Except for Mine or Threat.
Right.
And Fugazi and all that. But, like, you would be hard-pressed to find a great band that doesn't have substance abuse, like, mixed in there or mental illness. Or depression, or a disability, or something that makes them different. Because in my experience, that's what makes people gravitate towards art in the first place.
Yeah.
It's because they can't exactly express themselves by having a conversation. They need to create something, or... Which I'm actually so surprised I've been able to talk this whole time, because typically I'm like, I don't know what the fuck to say. Like,
well, I mean, you seem pretty lucid. I mean, there's definitely a lot going on. You're extremely thoughtful,
mm-hmm.
and you seem like you know a lot about a lot of things, and so of course you're gonna have a lot to say.
I guess.
So with all of that happening though, how did you find yourself homeless?
So my parents found out I was doing drugs and they let me graduate high school. And my dad came up to me and he told me, you have a month to get your shit together. If your shit isn't together in like a month, I'm done. And you're going to have to go. I thought he was full of shit. Month later, he woke me up at 7:30 a.m. and he was like, "Hey, bud, remember what I told you a month ago?" And I was all like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Your stuff's outside." And I had to go. And it was one of the weirdest things I ever experienced. Seeing all the people I went to high school with still with their families and all that.
Yeah.
Then me sitting outside chilling with these stray cats playing guitar.
Yeah.
Like, I was all like, what the fuck? This sucks.
Yeah.
And,
but like, you're still on heroin at this point.
No.
No.
No, I haven't done that shit ever since I was 19. I still smoke weed.
Yeah, but that's nothing.
Yeah, I haven't done hard.
No, I don't mean now. I mean at this point in the story.
Oh, when I was a kid, I thought you and we were talking about now.
No. Okay. I mean at this point in the story.
Yes, I was still doing a dope. And when it took me like six months of being homeless and like a junkie for me to get to that realization that, oh, okay, I need to do something or I'm going to die.
Yeah.
I remember calling my dad and I was like, "Hey, Dad, I want to go to rehab." And my dad was all like, "What?" And I was all like, "Yeah, I'm tired of doing this to myself. I never meant to hurt you or mom or any of my friends or anyone who cared about me. So I think it's time I get my shit together." Then we went to rehab. That rehab sucked. Like, fuck that place. So bad. But it gave me the tools I need to stay off of heroin. And I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
I got out of rehab. I went to a homeless shelter off of Route 1 in Northern Virginia, because that was the only place I could really find. And I got a job out there. I got my own place. I got the dog. That shit was like rad. I still have a dog. She's awesome. It's not the same dog, unfortunately. He passed. RIP.
Yeah. If you ever want to know what heartbreak feels like.
Yeah, lose a pet. That shit get a pet. Hurts.
Yeah.
I got tired of living out there, like I said, and something I got really sick of, the people I grew up with, at least the more ritzy side, the kids in the basement I was telling you about.
Yeah.
They never realized how racist and like misogynistic and ableist they could be. So I got real annoyed with that shit. And I was like, I need a new place. I need a change of scenery. So I moved out to Denver. I wound up homeless here for a little bit. Got my own place. And like I said, I started a band. Went to school. And yeah, now I'm sitting here speaking with you and I'm not dead.
Yeah. I mean, that's incredible to go through all of that shit and to still come out the other side with your head on straight.
Because you could have gone
the other way.
Yes.
And the other way that you could have gone with it, I mean, there are an infinite possibilities. Mm-hmm. You could have said, fuck all of this and checked out, which I'm sure you felt like at times.
I've attempted it. So the first time I was homeless, I attempted suicide by overdosing. when I got clean and I got my own place, I was living with this dude who was a Metro cop. And one night I grabbed his gun.
That's fucking crazy.
Yeah. I'll get into that in a second. But I grabbed his gun and I went out into the woods. And I checked the chamber, and there was one bullet in the chamber, and I was like, oh, word. So, this works out. Like, it'll be quick, it'll be done.
Yeah.
Put the gun in my mouth, I pulled the trigger, I kept jamming. I got super pissed, I pointed it at the ground, and then I shot it, and it, like, went off. And I was all like, oh, well, guess I'm supposed to be here? I'm gonna go smoke a bowl and, like, decompress after this. And I make light of it now.
Yeah, of course.
But at the moment, I was all like, what the fuck just happened?
Yeah. I mean, we've all had those. Well, I shouldn't say we've all had those close call suicide stories that are hilarious now. But for those of us that do, I mean, those stories can be pretty fucking ridiculous.
Yes.
I actually stole a gun from someone once. When I was about 17, and I thought this was the biggest find in the world, and it was from a friend of mine. His dad had guns everywhere,
yeah,
all over their house, not locked in a cabinet, just everywhere.
That's awful.
Yeah, so I know. So I stole one of the guns, and I was like, "This is my ticket," because I had tried pills. I had tried jumping in front of a train. I had tried, cutting my wrists open. Mm-hmm. I tried all that stuff. And, for one reason or another, it all failed. And of course, the moment you fail and you live, you go, oh fuck. Thank God I lived.
Yeah. It's like, what?
Yeah. But so I had this gun and I went to shoot myself with it. And I gave myself a really wicked welt from the BB that came out of it. and I had to explain that. I just told people I got a bee sting, on the side of my head, and nobody bought it. You know, it didn't look like I had done anything, but it was very depressing. It was very depressing. Yes. So, Andy, if you're listening, you know who you are. Yeah, I stole your BB gun. So, yeah, it looked real. I couldn't tell the difference. I'd never seen a gun before, you know?
Yeah, no, most certainly. Like, so with living with this cop, I don't know how I got away with half of the shit I was doing. Because it was in the Northern Virginia, D.C. metropolitan area. An air in Rhea.
Yeah.
So, weed was absolutely illegal. Like,
yeah.
Nope. Like, and he specifically told me when I moved in, and he was all like, you look like one of those pot smokers. You don't have that shit here. And I was like, oh, and like, okay, Dave, I got you.
Only Bible studies.
Yep.
No.
I am pure.
None of the funny cigarettes for me, thank you.
So, he came home once. And he wasn't supposed to be home all weekend, so I was blazing up a storm in there. And he came home once, and he was all like, Chris, are you smoking weed? And I was like, no, dude, I'm burning incense. And he was all like, oh, that looks like a marijuana bowl. I was like, is it? I thought you would put incense in there. Look, I bought this bag of incense. And I pulled out my weed, and he's like, that looks like weed. I'm like, nah, dude, I bought it at the tobacco store, like, right up the street. Thank God there were those herbal incense shit that you put in, like, stuff and you burn.
Yeah.
That looks like weed up there, because he went and checked. And he was like, well, I guess you weren't lying. That's interesting. It smells like weed, though. And I was all like, oh, I'm sorry, I'll get the smell out. And I was all like, oh, thank God, this guy's a cop.
Yeah, a Metro cop and not a detective.
So, when I moved out, I looked at Dave. I was like, hey, Dave, Remember when you came home and you said you smelled weed and I said it was incense and he was like, yeah. I was like, yeah. I was blazing up a fucking, like, storm. I was super high. And you're dumb, because you believe that. You have a good day, you boot and liquor. Yep. It's the highlight of me dealing with any cop.
I had taken a job as a security guard once.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the worst thing ever. That exacerbated my depression.
I believe it.
You were literally trained to racially profile people.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole thing was just set up to fail for everyone involved. It was so nerve-wracking, and it was unbelievably depressing. I started having panic attacks because I hated my job so much. And then the final straw was I was in my dumb little uniform at a German village in Michigan, and I caught a girl shoplifting a ring for her mother on Mother's Day. And come to find out that she was a single mom. Things had been stressful, and they were out for the day just to do something nice together. And this girl decided, I don't have any money. I'm going to get my mom a ring. And I busted her. And I never felt more like shit in my life. Because it was too late. I mean, all I saw was, there's a girl, she's stealing a ring, I caught her, I take her to the office, and then everything unfolds in front of me. And it's like, what the fuck did I just do? Who did I become? When did I become security guard guy?
Yeah.
Like, because I believe in case-by-case basis, and I also believe, fuck this store. Like,
yep.
I don't have anything emotionally invested in this store, and so you would have got away with it. Good for you. Like, that's, I don't know what else to do with that. I could have let her off with a warning. I could have said, hey, don't do that. Or something. Who knows? I mean, I have no idea if that impacted her negatively or positively. Like, you know what? I learned not to steal. I would have become a crime lord and died at a young age if I had gotten away with it. But, I don't know. I don't feel good about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't feel good about it. So I quit.
Yeah.
I just straight up quit. I was like, this is, maybe somebody else has the mental fortitude to be able to go, I'm going to shut this part of my brain off when I'm at work. And when I'm not at work, I don't think about these people. And maybe someone else is smarter and they're able to determine who should I let go and who should I stop. I can't tell that shit. It's not my job to be a judge.
Yep.
I don't have it in me.
Yep, it's... So...
And you know what? I don't think most people do.
One of the things that drove me nuts about where you're working at the homeless shelter I worked at, there's a shitty place called New Genesis.
Yeah.
If somebody came in drunk or high, we had to kick him out for, like, the night. And the director was an addict herself, too. And I'm like, yo, like, I understand if it's, like, repeat offenses, us doing that. But the first time, or the second time, like, relapse is a part of, like, recovery. Us throwing them out on the streets, they're just going to go to a friend's house or go get fucked up in a, like, alleyway.
Yeah.
Like, you're not doing anything to help these people. So that's another reason why I quit. I couldn't do much. all the stories were starting to get to me and making me want to go out and get high. Then shitty management who were charging people $63 a week to sleep on a floor mat in the basement of a fucking church.
Yeah.
Like, that's slumlord shit.
Yeah.
So I was all like, yeah, I'm done.
I don't think most people have any kind of idea what goes into working at a homeless shelter or even being homeless and what it's like to have the day-to-day on that.
That's part of, and the reason I'm doing this show, and I booked in the bands I did. Like I was telling you earlier, a lot of my lyrical content, where it's abstract, it has to do with my depression, my addiction issues, and being homeless. I also have one song I like wrote about my dog. So that's a pretty rad song. It's still angry, but the like lyrics are super loving and all that, because I love my Pibble. She's so good.
Yeah. But, they're the best fucking dogs.
They really are. Them and boxers are just prime. So I also plan on letting the people know who attend that, hey, please donate something, because like there are people out there who need help. And the places where I'm donating this money to, where and you're donating to, like, I it's going to help them. Like, I mean, yeah, I don't expect to bring in like fucking like $500+ or something, but whatever I can bring into a help, that's what I want to do.
Well, I think that's a worthy goal.
Yeah, it's again, to touch on Connor a little bit more. A kid who's 17, who's working a full-time job, he's paying his own rent, and he's almost been homeless twice since turning 17.
Like, yeah.
I'm not going to go into the details about his story, but it's not.
Yeah, I suppose that's
place.
His story to tell.
Yeah. But it's really cool to see a kid like him, and I say kid very, very loosely. He's actually one of the more mature people I've met since playing, like, in the band I do now.
Sure.
But seeing people like him and people like myself who have pulled ourselves up from nothing and now we're doing stuff like this. Like, if that doesn't say these people who suffer from mental illnesses or addiction or homelessness, whatever, aren't worth it, then I don't know what does. Like, something I always, and something I've noticed, especially with going downtown and living in DC and being homeless myself, is if you're homeless, people don't look at you.
Yeah.
They try and avoid eye contact, they look away, they look down. And it's like, yo, you understand I'm like a person too.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not some leper or something. I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm not going to. You're not going to contract homelessness from talking into me.
Yeah.
And people do with that with people who are different. Whether it be somebody who's gay, somebody who's a person of color,
yeah.
somebody who's a trans, people fear what they don't understand.
Right.
And that's not it fair, because there are a lot of people out there who are genuinely good people who are different. And just because they're different, it doesn't mean they need to be ostracized or pushed aside. Like, they're a person too. Accept them. Like, what's it going to a hurt if you see a trans person and you don't misgender them to be a dick and you call them what they asked to be called by? It's not that hard. Me with a disability, every time I go into Starbucks or something, or McDonald's, and I stutter, about 5 out of 10 times, it's about half, somebody laughs. And they're like, oh, I thought you and were joking. It's like, no, you fucking asshole. You don't just laugh at somebody. Like,
yeah,
that's fucking rude.
Yeah.
And it's real infuriating. And I do find it funny when people are like, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And it's like, if you were sorry, you wouldn't have done it in the first place.
Yeah.
So next time you meet somebody who's different, just don't laugh at them. Don't fucking apologize to me, because I really don't want to hear it. I don't care.
You've just revealed yourself to be an asshole.
Yeah. Like, you aren't worth in my time at this point. So, it's... I wish that there was a switch that you could just flick and people would get it, and they'd be like, oh, what I said may have been incredibly intolerant, ableist, racist, insert what, like, white people do here.
Yeah. Yeah, but then you'd get people who are looking at the switch going, well, why do I gotta flip the switch?
True. True. And so I wish that there was a switch to make them flip that switch.
So, I guess, as we're wrapping it up here, and we've really gone all over the place, and it's really been an undescribable conversation.
Thanks.
No, it really, you kept me on my toes, and I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Are you still good with your folks?
Yes.
That's awesome.
I speak with my mom and dad at least once every two weeks. I try and stay in contact more, and I probably should call them a lot more, I don't know, I get busy with life, I play music, I have a dog, they're not a dog, like, they're not as interesting, like, it's my pupper, and they don't play music. So, Mom, Dad, you pick up a guitar and I'll call you more often. But no, all jokes aside, we do get along. It took us a little while. There was a lot of compromise on both sides. Like, it blew my mind. Like I said earlier, when my mom and dad, when I was explaining why I feel what they did was wrong, whether it be kicking me out or forcing me to do something or just little things. It blew my mind when they were like, you know, maybe we did make a mistake. Because something they would say a lot, and this is something they've actually apologized recently for, is anytime I'd have a milestone, I'd get clean. They'd be like, oh, you can move back. So I'm getting out of rehab. Hey, can I have a place to stay? No. Oh. You fucking lied. You get a job first, then talk to us. Hey, I got the job. Can I move back in? No. Where the fuck am I supposed to sleep? Just little things. So...
Oh, yeah, little things, like not giving you somewhere to live.
Exactly. So,
Of course.
I was talking to them about that about a little less than a year ago. And I was all like, you know you all deceive me, right? And they were all like, yeah, you understand you're now self and, like, sufficient now. And I was like, I get that. And I truly appreciate it. Obviously, I picked up on what you guys were doing. Hence why I just stopped asking for a place to stay. But there were times that I was clean and I just wound up in a shitty situation. And you guys weren't exactly there. And there's a little bit of, like, resentment. And that's when it clicked and they were all like, oh, shit. We did essentially manipulate you instead of just saying, no, you can't come home. It's time for you to do your own thing.
Yeah.
And they apologized about that. Finally got my mom to apologize about trying and to ban Nirvana from like the house. It's funny, my band went and played in D.C., and when she came out and saw us, I intentionally covered a Nirvana song just to piss her off. And,
you gotta get your jabs in while you can.
So, my mom absolutely hated the intro and the song Territorial Pissings. So I looked right at her and screamed at the top of my lungs in the way that Novoselic did. Come on, people now, smile on your brother. And my mom looked at me and just went... And then she saw a crowd of 100+ of people beat the shit out of each other to like that song. And my mom was up against the wall like, what the fuck is going on? I'm like, Mom, it's punk rock. Like,
yeah.
You've never been to a punk show? And she's like, no, I go to fucking Luke Bryan shows and all they do is dance.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, because they suck.
Yeah, my folks came and saw my band and once and they still talk about it to this day. And once there was a gentleman with a dog collar on. Can you believe it?
So
yeah, good times.
During our last song, it's a song I wrote called Emos and Stage Fright. The crowd was moshing and beating the shit out of each other. And I jumped in front of my mom. And my mom thought I was going to, like, ram her. And she jumped back and I, like, just, like, eased back into and, like, the mosh pit with this giant smirk on my face. Then my mom proceeded to see us smash everything. Smash my guitar, we smashed the drum set, we do smash the bass stuff. Like, the bass stuff wasn't even ours, so I felt bad about that. To everyone I've borrowed equipment from in Denver, I promise I will not do that to you.
Yeah, you don't want to get a reputation.
It wasn't, so we had a fill-in basis for that show, because Hollis couldn't make it, and, I don't think he realized that stuff wasn't ours. So he's just fucked it all up. And I looked at that band and I like reached in my wallet and I gave him $200 and I was all like, I'm sorry. And they handed me back the $200 and they were all like, you're good. That and wasn't like the coolest set I've ever seen a band play. And I was all like, Fred!
Oh, good. I'm going to leave before you think about that.
Yeah. I got to go. I'm going to go get paid out. You have a good night.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's good. That's good that you still have that relationship and that you're out there making the music and bringing awareness to something that is absolutely a huge problem, especially in a city like Denver.
Mm-hmm. And it's... Every city across the U.S.
Yeah.
is dealing with a, like, youth homelessness issue, actually just a like homelessness issue, period. People mention Denver and the gentrification and all that. That's going on all across the like U.S.
Yeah.
It's going on in Oklahoma City. It's going on up in Seattle. It's going on in Portland. It's going on in D.C. and New York and Philly. Like, and D.C. is already expensive as fuck.
Yeah.
So everything they are doing there just pisses me off. Like, can you raise the rent on the fucking White House and get Trump out of there instead? Like, instead of kicking out all these minority families, should kick out the fucking orange dickhead in fucking office. So yeah, I really hope, especially with how people are starting to realize that, okay, now the middle class is being affected. White America is being affected.
Yeah.
By gentrification. Like, I really hope this is an eye-opener. Because, and it sucks it has to be white America that gets the attention. And that makes it a big deal. Because that's why the opiate epidemic was such a big deal. No one cared when homeless people like and myself or a person of color or somebody who was different was out on the street doing opiates. But the second it then like hit the suburbs, it was like, it's so bad now. It's like, yo, it's always been there. Like, this is why Reagan should have never had that war on drugs. He put that shit in the fucking inner cities and then wondered why it's affecting, quote, his people.
Yeah.
You put it there. And these people need a way to make money. Well, who better to sell to than stuffy white people in the suburbs who actually have the money? So it's all cause and like effect. Like it's the war on drugs' fault. This is happening in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's pretty heavy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm glad that you're doing what you're doing, and that you are continuing to be loud. And in people's faces.
Always.
And thanks for talking to me.
Anytime. And thanks and for having me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Oh, man. Again, do you see what I mean? There were so many areas that I wanted to go down. And it just, you can't get to everything. You just can't get to everything. But I'll tell you what. You can get yourself down to the Marquee Theater on the 21st of December, 2018, and right before Christmas. Try to help out the homeless and get your boogie shoes on at the same time. Do some rocket boogie shoes. What the fuck? I don't talk like that. Oh my God. This has been an absolute blast, and there's one more episode to stick in your stocking before the end of the year. And then we'll be back for a second season, but I'll always be here, and as always, don't kill yourselves out there.